Okay, we're beginning on the top of Kuf Nun Aleph Amud Aleph, five lines down. Here the Gemara is continuing to discuss what is subsumed under the term Nechasai. If a person gives away his possessions, his assets, through the terminology of Nechasai, what's included under that term? So the Gemara already had gone through the fact that land, your metaltalin, currency, shtarot, are all subsumed under this term Nechasai. And here the Gemara continues, Behema Ikre Nechasai. That an animal is also called neches, or subsuner that term. Titanan, we have a Mishnah in Shkalim, Hamakdish nechasav, someone who consecrates all of his possessions. Vaitabahen behema ruyad gabe mizbeach. Amongst those parts of his possessions, there was an animal that was ra'ui to go on the mizbeach. Zicharim, if they are male animals, then you bring them as olot. Nekevot, imachru letzorche zivche shlamim. You can see here the Gota Brach brings the alternate girsa, because there are two opinions in the Mishnah there. And so therefore, first one would be Zacharim, Yimachru, the Olot, that the Zacharim should be sold to be used as a lot, and the Nekevot, Yimachru, the Torchei Zivchei Shlamim. And the Nekevot should be sold to be used as Zivchei Shlamim. Either way, the halacha that derives from here is not as important as the fact that when it says he gave away all of his possessions, that in that category are behemoth. Animals are clearly included under that terminology, and then they're dealing with what do you do with these animals that are away the mizbeach. Do you bring the zecharim as olot, or you sell the shlamim, or do you sell all of them and use those monies from the mikdash and then have them go on the mizbeach? Ofot ikre nechsei, ofot, birds also are included under this terminology, titzanan. A magdish nechasav, someone who consecrates all of his possessions, vayuben dvarim aru in the gabi mizbeach. Amongst them are items that belong on the mizbeach or can be used on the mizbeach. Yenot, wines, shmanim, oils, velvot, and birds. So here again, you see clearly that birds are included under the terminology when he is consecrating, he's giving to Hekdesh all of his nechasim. I would think all ofot are included. It just happens to be in this case, what's relevant is what's ro'i the mizbeach. Over there, all of his nechasim will be mukdash. It's specifically delineating these items because they can go on the mizbeach, so they have a different din than everything else. Everything else is sold, liquidated, and then the cash belongs to Hekdesh with the Berek Abayit. On the other hand, here we have items that can actually go on the mizbeach that takes on a different form of Hekdesh. So I don't think it's unique to the ofot that go on the mizbeach. The din is, but not the fact that they're subsumed under nechsei. I think they would apply to all ofot. Tfilin, ikre nechsei. Tfilin are also called nechasim. Titznan, mishnah arachin, magdish nechasav. Someone who's magdish all of his possessions. Ma'alin lo tfilin. Then we do something for his tfilin. Here is machloki between the Rishbam and the Rabbeinu Gershom as to what you do. The Rishbam reads it, ma'alin lo bidamim. We give him an assessment of the value, upodim b'shavien, and then he redeems them at their fair value. He needs his tefillin, but his makdish, all of his possessions, his tefillin went along with it. But he needs to wear his tefillin, he needs to put them on. So we give him the right to redeem the tefillin and buy them back from Hekdesh, and we assign a value that he could do it with. That's the way umalin lo tefillin according to the Rishbam. The Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, says, notim otan mimenu, v'yu Hekdesh. Malin otan means, they're gone. He was makdish them, Hekdesh takes the tefillin, and they keep the tefillin, he no longer has his tefillin. Either way, no matter which way you read it, tefillin are clearly subsumed under this category of makdish nechasav. So nechasim include tefillin as well. Ibayiluhu. So here we have the question that is posed, one item that we're not sure as to whether it is subsumed under this category. Sefer Torah mai. Comes to the Sefer Torah, what's the din? Kevan delo mizdabon, since you can't sell a Sefer Torah, tasfur lizvune, tasur to sell a Sefer Torah, lav nechsehu, doesn't qualify as neches, assets, possessions, those are items that belong to you, that you can liquidate them, you can sell them, you can do with them as you please. The Sefer Torah comes with a lot of restrictions, including one restriction is that you're not allowed to sell a Sefer Torah. So maybe that already takes it out of the world of nechasim because of the fact that it can't be sold. Odilma, or maybe came into mizdabon. Maybe there are cases or exceptional cases where you can sell a sefer Torah, l'mod Torah, v'lisa isha, and because of that nechsehu, classified as a neches. So the sefer Torah is the davar hachi kadosh. It is the thing that is the most sanctified out of any object. So in the Mishnayot and Gemara in Megillah, it describes what you're allowed to do with items that have sanctity to them. Those items that have kedusha associated with them, you can sell them only to procure something that is more kadosh. The problem with the Sefer Torah is that you've reached the pinnacle of what is kadosh. So you can't sell it to buy anything else, because in and of itself, it is the most kadosh item. So there, the Gemara brings that there are exceptions to that rule, where the exceptions are such great mitzvot, or so important, that we allow them to override that usual restriction against selling a Sefer Torah. So you're allowed to sell a Sefer Torah in order to learn Torah. There, it might even be a facilitation, which is the point of having a Torah is to learn Torah. Therefore, maybe you're allowed to sell the Torah in order to learn Torah. V'lisa isha, and to get married. Again, it's such a basic, fundamental mitzvah, getting married and raising a family, that mitzvah allows one to sell a Sefer Torah in order to facilitate the ability to marry. To your question, the Tosafot back on Chet Amud Bet says, Pidyon Shvuim Mitzvah Rabah. The Pidyon Shvuim is a great mitzvah. V'adamar Reperek Bnei Ayir, Ein Mochrim Sefer Torah, L'Limod Torah, V'lisa Isha. V'lo Ktani Pidyon Shvuim. Pidyon Shvuim is not mentioned there. Shema Milta De Pshita, Hei V'lo Yitzrach De Mechtevei. So maybe it's just so simple and so straightforward, you don't have to write it. That's the view of the Bali Tosavot here in Chet Amud Bet, in the beginning of Baba Batra. But you could also disagree and say that Pidyon Shvuim is not included under the category of items that you could sell a Sefer Torah for. But those are the exceptions to the rule. Otherwise, you can't sell a Sefer Torah. So the Safek that is raised here in the Gemara is a Sefer Torah looked at or viewed as a Neches because there's an ability to sell it in certain circumstances? Or is it not viewed as a Neches because you're not allowed in general to sell it? And therefore, it's not like your usual possession or assets. In some ways, it's taken away from you. You don't have the rights that you can normally exert upon a possession of yours, an asset of yours. Those rights are suspended here because of the nature of the Sefer Torah. It's as if the Sefer Torah belongs to you, but doesn't belong to you. So maybe that's not classified as a neches. Now, what's interesting about the Gemara over here is that the Gemara makes an assumption that if you could sell it, then for sure the Sefer Torah would be considered a neches. But the Gemara brings no evidence of that. For every other item before this, the Gemara brought evidence of the fact that it is a neches. So things that you would have thought for sure are nechasim, property, mitaltalim. Nevertheless, the Gemara brought mishtayot to substantiate the fact that they're included. But here the Gemara brings no substantiation as to whether a Torah would be considered or would be called even neches. Forget about whether the restrictions on the Sefer Torah have impact. It doesn't tell you why you would have a havamina to think that it is a neches, irrespective of the ability to sell it. So here the Rashbam says, first of all, Mimikre nechse kit tefillin damu. He sees it as an extension of tefillin. Tefillin are called neches. Tefillin are just like a mini Sefer Torah. They're just a Sefer Torah with fewer parshiot that are in it. So if tefillin are considered to be a neches, then a Sefer Torah should also be classified as a neches. So then he says, O Dilma, tefillin ainu taimo, davi malbush. Tefillin are much more personal items. They're something you wear. So maybe it's classified as a malbush. Av a sefer mitzvah. Sefer Torah is simply a mitzvah. It's not a personal item. And therefore, it's not considered to be a neches. So in this, you can either look at this as a bigger question about the Sefer Torah status, or you even might see it as a multi-level question, which is, first of all, would you consider a Sefer Torah a neches at all? Maybe because it's similar to tefillin, it is a neches. Or maybe it's not a neches because tefillin are a malbush and a Sefer Torah is not. Now, even if you think it is like tefillin, maybe it's still disqualified from being a neches because it has a different din than tefillin. Tefillin can be sold, a Sefer Torah cannot be sold. So that seems to be the nature of the question according to the Rashbam. Tosfot, on the other hand, deals with this in another manner, which is to say that nechasim she'en le'machrayut would definitely include a Sefer Torah. You can be kone a Sefer Torah but through a kinyan agav, and therefore would be subsumed under the category of assets that the Mishnah and Kiddushin calls nechasim she'en le'machrayut. Tosfot then goes on to say that maybe that's exactly what the safek of the Gemara is over here, which is that even though it may be classified as nechasim she'en le'machrayut, nevertheless, it would not be considered your neches or your nechasim because of the restrictions of the sale. So even though, yes, you can make a kinyan on it through a kinyan agav, but maybe it still will not be referenced to as a neches and be considered as part of the gift because of the restrictions of selling that are placed in the Sefer Torah that takes it out of the world of nechasim. Right, so Gemara leaves it as a teiku, as an unresolved issue. Now we're going to have a number of cases, stories about matnot shchemera, and then here the Gemara is going to clarify what we've, in essence, been discussing all along, which is, how did the dinim of matnat shchemera work? We've said all along that there are differences between if you give away all of it, to give a portion of it, you need a kinyan, you don't need a kinyan. All of that is brought together here from the cases that we see in the Piske Halacha that come out of these cases. Ime de Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia, the mother of Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia, kadvinu l'nechsa the Rav Zutra Bar Tuvia. She gave over, she granted all of her possessions to her son, de Bail and Suvele the Rav Zvid, because she wanted to marry Rav Zvid, and so therefore she wanted to use this as a prenuptial agreement, in essence to make sure that the assets didn't go to Rav Zvid as her husband, so she gifted them all to her son prior to her marriage. In Siva, she got married, Vigarsha, and then she got divorced. Atzio de Kamei de Rav Bibi Bar Abaye, so she came before Rav Bibi Bar Abaye to get her possessions back from her son, because she only granted them to her son because she was getting married. Amar, Mishum in Suve, you gave it to him because you intended to get married, Van Siva, and you got married. I mean, the point of giving him to your son was because you thought you were going to get married, and that's what happened. You did get married. Since you got married, then the gift was a real gift, and therefore it should remain with your son. Amalei Ravuna Breid Rav Yeshua. So Ravuna Breid Rav Yeshua says to Rav Bibi Bar Abaye, Shum Da'ate Mimulai Amrita Milei Mulyoto. So again, we saw this back on Kuflam and Zayin and Mudbet. Over there we discussed the different possibilities about the term Mimulai. The way that the Rashbam favors over here is that Shem Makom. Mulai is the name of a place where numerous individuals from the family of Beit Eli lived. And we know that the curse of Beit Eli that is brought in the beginning of Shmuel Aleph is that none of the individuals from that family will live a long life. They will all pass away young. And Abaye and Ravar are from Beit Eli. The Gemara in Rosh Hashanah discusses the fact that they were passing away young because of the fact they were from Beit Eli. And there the Gemara discusses the fact that since they were Osik B'Torah and Chesed, they were able to postpone that verdict and they didn't die as young as they should have since they were from Beit Eli. So here you have Rav Bibi Bar Abaye, so he's also from Beit Eli. And therefore he says, since you are from Mimulai, this place where the family of Beit Eli resides, Rita Mile Mulyoto. Therefore, you say over words that are either bali mumin, that's the way the Rashbam says it, words that are cut off, words that don't make sense, they're just a bunch of air, they don't have any content to them. And again, the word mimulai, back on Kuflam and Zayin of Bet, there we discussed also the other possibilities that it could also have a negative and positive connotation. Mimulai could just simply mean mi Beit Eli, that they were just from the family of Beit Eli, or that since you are mimulai in the positive sense, since you are full, so erudite, such tamidei chachamim, mija milio milioto, therefore you say something that's very full, but in a sense it's a lashon sagi nahor, because of your sharpness and your erudition, you overlooked something over here, and said something that's not really correct. Afilu lamanda amar mavrechet kani, even according to the one who says that mavrechet works to establish a kinyan, Hani mile heche de lo galio dato. That's only a case where she doesn't expressly say why she's doing it. V'hocha, in our instance, galio dato de mishum in tzuvehu. She made it clear and apparent the reason she was doing this is because of the marriage. So when we read the story, I read you the story that when she said, I'm doing this because she wanted to get married to Rav Zvid, I read that as part of the narration of the story. Simply, she gave the gift to her son because she was going to get married. The way that you need to read this and the way that Ravuna Brei Rav Yeshua is saying is that this woman actually stated explicitly, the reason I'm giving this gift to my son, Rav Zutra Bar Tovia, is the Bailen Tzubele, the Rav Zvid, because I'm getting married to Rav Zvid. It wasn't part of the narrative, it was expressly what she said when she gifted this item to her son. So she embedded, in essence, a T'nai in the gift to her son, which is the reason I'm giving it to you is because I'm getting married. That means, va intziba vigarsha. And she got married, and then she got divorced. So if it was premised on the marriage, at the dissolution of the marriage, then the gift is now reversed. So now there are two things to look at here. First of all, that we say, afilu leman da'amar dekana. Even according to the one who says that you are koneh, Tosafot already clarifies, that's a machloket Rabbi Shimon ben Gamliel and the Chachamim in the Mishnah in Ketubot. And the Mishnah that we spoke about yesterday, when we spoke about Rabbi Brechet, was a libid to Rabbi Shimon. According to Rabbi Shimon's opinion, the Bali Tosafot over here say that this is according to the Chachamim because, Tzarech lemar d'mayriv miksat nechasim. It's, we're discussing here that she only gave a portion of her possessions. De'i b'chol nechasim pshita de lo kana. If she gave away all of her possessions, then even the Chachamim would agree that the Mavrechet is only a temporary gift, and if the marriage dissolves, she'll get the gift back. So according to the Bali of Tosafot, Rabbi Shimon Gamliel and the Chachamim do not argue in that instance of where you gave away all your possessions, because there it's obvious that you're doing as Mavrechet. It's only when you give away a portion of your possessions where we have that uncertainty. And that's where the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon argue. And then you have here the Gemara saying that even according to the Chachamim, who say generally that Mavrechet is koneh, and therefore, you can't get it back. In this instance, since she was explicit in her reference to the fact that she was giving it away because of the marriage, even the Chachamim would agree that you can reverse that transaction when the marriage dissolves. So that's number one. Number two is that from the conclusion of the Gemara over here, it says, Mishom de insubehu, v'ha insiva v'irgarsha. She got married and she got divorced. From that, you can see, that's what the Tosfot says here, v'chein gores Rabbeinu Chananel. The girsa that we have in our Gemara is the same girsa of Rabbeinu Chananel, ve'enu niradari. Hebrew says, I don't think it's right. Because over here it stipulates, basically, that she can only unwind the gift if she gets divorced. That the marriage in of itself will lock the gift in until she gets divorced, and then she gets the right to take the gift back. But that would imply that it's a full-fledged gift unless she gets divorced. The way that we learned Mavrechet in general in the statement is that if she says, Me'ayom, u'gsheretza, when, from today, and when I want to, whenever I feel like it, I can take the gift back. And we said yesterday, and the Rashbam brought such language yesterday, that implicit in a gift of all your property is exactly that. That I'm giving you the gift now, for whenever I want to pull it back. Whenever I decide that I don't want you to have it anymore, that'll be the case. And therefore, the Gemara states it in the following manner, that you can play both sides. If the current husband comes to get the possession, she can say, no, it belongs to the person that I gave the kinyan to. If the person with the kinyan comes to make a claim, she says, well, it says in there, l'kasheretze, and I don't want you to have it right now. So she's able to exercise both sides of it and block either party from taking full possession of the asset. But over here, the Gemara sounds like that's not true. It's not up to her. It has to do whether the marriage was intact or dissolved. And that's what the Reed doesn't like over here. Even when she's under the auspices of her husband, the buyer does not have possession of it. The Chachamim made it as if she sold them. So then Tosafot tries to deal with the Girsa that's here and says, maybe you could say, even though the Baal doesn't get them, the new husband doesn't get them, and the party holding onto the assets for him doesn't get them, he becomes, in essence, like a shomer, or they're in his possession until she gets divorced. So Tosafot gives one of two answers, either that you should eliminate this from the Girsa, because it's just not true, even if she doesn't get divorced, she can pull the asset back, that's one possibility, or if you want to leave the Girsa intact, even though the husband doesn't have rights to it, and the one she gave it to, the lokeach, has no rights to it, or the recipient has no rights to it, nevertheless, she can't get it back until she gets divorced. So he stipulates that maybe that's the way to explain her, that's the way to deal with it over here. Okay, another story. Eime de Rami Bar Chama. The mother of Rami Bar Chama, Ba'urta, at night, Kotvino de Nechsa, the Rami Bar Chama. At night, she gave all of her possessions to Rami Bar Chama. B'tzafra, in the morning, Kotvino de Rav Ukva Bar Chama. She gave it all to his brother, Rav Ukva. Ata Rami Bar Chama lekamei de Rav Sheshet. So Rami Bar Chama went to Rav Sheshet, Ukmei b'nechse. He gave him all the possessions. His mother had granted him first the rights to the possessions. And therefore Rav Sheshet says, you are entitled to them. You can go take possession of them. Azal Rav Ukva Bar Chama kamei de Rav Nachman. So Rav Ukva Bar Chama went to Rav Nachman. So he happened to pick the stronger Dayan over here. And that's probably a good move. Ukmei b'nechse. Rav Nachman says that you have the right to the possessions. Azal Rav Sheshet the kamei de Rav Nachman. So Rav Sheshet comes to Rav Nachman to discuss the case. The two judges need to decide here what's going to happen. Amalei, my taimo, ukme, mar, the Rav Ukva bar Chama. So Rav Sheshit says to Rav Nachman, what are you doing putting Rav Ukva into the possessions? Imishum de hadraba. If it is because she relented on the gift that she gave to Rami bar Chama, vashchiva, she passed away. She died. And if she died, then a matnat shchimera is binding. The matnat shchimera was first given to Rami bar Chama, and then she passed away. Since she passed away, it is a binding gift. And if it's a binding gift, then Rami bar Chama was the first one was given the gift, and you should have no rights to put Rav Ukva into the property. Amalei, Hachi Amar Shmuel, this is what Shmuel says. Kol Shilu Amad Chuzer, Chuzer B'matanato. So Rav Nachman says, Rav Nachman's a Talmid of Shmuel, so Rav Nachman says, this is what Shmuel says. Any possession which, if the Shchimera had survived, would have the gift retracted, then they have a right to retract the gift even before they pass away. So over here, his mother gave him the gift. It was a matnat shchimera. Had she survived, she'd be able to take that gift back from Rami bar Chama because she survived. That means that she has sufficient rights to this gift to control it still. Because if she survives, it's hers. That control also grants her the right to change who the beneficiary of that gift is. She gave it to Rami bar Chama, and then she changed her mind and gave it to Rav Ukva. Or in essence, this is what we learned before, daidiki mevatelet daidiki. That a matnat shchimera can override a previous matnat shchimera. So now Rav Sheshit responds to him and says, imodomer Shmuel atzmo, lacher mi'amar. Wait a minute, you could narrow the scope of Shmuel's statement to the following, which is that a shchimera, if they survive, has a right to retract the gift. Therefore, Shmuel says that even if they do pass away, if prior to their passing away they want to retract the gift, they can retract it. But retracting the gift means they can take it back into their own possession. Doesn't mean they can gift it to someone else. You have a right to retract it and keep it for yourself, just like if you survived, your right is to retract it and take it back for yourself. So too, if you pass away, then you have a right to retract it and keep it for yourself, and then go to the Yorshim. What you don't have a right to do is then to pass it to another party. You can't replace the beneficiary of your matnat shchimera with another beneficiary. So Amalei, so Rav Nachman says back to him, Beferush Amar Shmuel, that your narrowing of the scope of the statement Shmuel is incorrect, because Shmuel said, Ben Latzmo, Ben Lacher. It makes no difference whether you take it back to grant it to another party, or you take it back to keep it for yourself. Either way, a shchimera has a right to change the beneficiary. And this is the halacha that we've been working with all along, which is that a matnat shchimera allows the party who's granting it to change their mind, or to give a new will and testament that overrides the previous will and testament, and that is the daidiki mevatela daidiki, that they have a right to move around this asset to the beneficiary that they please, and the last beneficiary will be the one who gets it when they pass away. And that's what happened over here. Rav Ukva was the last beneficiary, and therefore he's going to get the asset, and Rav Nachman prevails over Rav Sheshet. So the Rishonim do argue over here, if you use some sort of formalized type of kinyan to reinforce the matnat shchimera, does that kinyan then bind you to the point where you can't gift it to someone else? Yes, still, if you survive, you'll be able to retract the gift, even though you used a kinyan or use some sort of language that indicates that the kinyan is effective immediately. There, if you don't pass away, you'll be able to retract or renege on that gift, because that's a presumed condition of the gift, which is that you're going to pass away. But if the individual does pass away, then it will be a binding gift, but it might be so binding that the person doesn't have a right to then change who they give it to. That matnat shchimera may be bound by the kinyan to the point that you can't give another matnat shchimera. That's the view of the Ritva. Other Rishonim disagree and say that even in a case where there's a reinforcing of language or kinyan, the person, since the premise of this principle given by Shmuel is, since if you survived, you could take it back. Therefore, while you are still awaiting passing away, the individual has the right to then change it from one party to another party, and that should be irrespective of kinyan, just like if the person survives, it's irrespective if there was a kinyan done. Now, what's interesting over here, if you look at the case with Ime the Rav Rabbi Bar Chama, said that at night, Ba'urta kadvinu l'nechsal Rami bar Chama b'tzafra. In the next morning that she gave it to the other child. So over here, the Rashbam says something interesting. The maskana of the sugi here is acharon kana, mishom dehadra ba mirishom. Because she backed out of the first one, so therefore, that's considered to be a retraction of the first gift, and then the second gift is binding. Uperek mishaya nasoi biktubot. Over there, ika masi achrine. They have a different case. Ema derami barchama bitzafra. His mother gave the gift in the morning. Kadvino neksai derami barchama. Lorta, at night, kadvino lamar uk deravokva. She gave it to the other brother, maravokva. Ate rami barchama, the commander of Sheshit, in the case of Rav Nachman. And they have the same altercation between Rav Sheshit and Rav Nachman over there in the Gemara in Ketubot. So the Gemara in Ketubot has a slight change to the story, which is the story here starts out at night, and then the gift is changed in the morning. In Ketubot, the gift starts in the morning, and then is changed at night. So that's interesting, I'll tell you why in a second. The second difference between them is Umaskana. The conclusion of the Sugya in Ketubot is Shoda de Daine. It's up to the Dayanim to decide. They can decide what to do with it. They have the Machloket Rashi in the Bali Tosafot as to whether Shoda de Daine means that the Dayanim can do as they please, or whether the Dayanim have to think about what the bequeather wanted to happen over here and favor that based on what they come to. Ula hakdama lo chashinan. We don't worry about the fact that one was before the other. So how come in our case we say whoever was first loses out, the latter one is governed? And over here, in the case in Ketubot, it says, Shoda de Daine. It doesn't say that the latter gift was binding. Ho, b'yom echad nechtivu. Because in the case in Ketubot, they were written on one day. So therefore, there's a difference in the din there versus the din over here. The din over here was that they were written on 2 days. And therefore, the second gift overrides the first gift. On the other hand, in the case in Ketubot, they were both written on the same day. Since they were written on the same day, we don't look as one being before the other because it has the same day. He says the way to deal with that maybe is to say that the cases are different. That the case of Ketubot was a matnat bari, and the case over here was a matnat shchimira. Shchimira lo shna b'yom echad, lo shna b'shnei yamim. Acharon koni da'adar be mikamei. By shchimira, it doesn't matter which day or what day you do it on; it's whatever's last governs. So the Rashbam gives two possible answers as to how to reconcile with that gemara in Ketubot. One answer is to say that the gift was on 1 day versus 2 days. When it's on 1 day, then it showed the Daina. When it's on 2 days, then it goes after the Acharon. And that's the difference between the two cases. Or to say that the case over there was Matnat Bari, and over here it's a Matnat Shchimira. A Matnat Shchimira has different rules than a Matnat Bari. A Matnat Bari is binding on the one first one who gets it, because there there's a Kinyan, it's sealed. Whereas a Matnat Shchimira, because it doesn't have the Kinyan involved with it, it has a right of retraction embedded in it, so therefore you can change your mind even after you gifted it. So that's how he explains it. Obviously, that would be strange because you have the same story. And in that same story, you have different outcomes. So that's interesting, but he's trying to reconcile between them. What I think is the most interesting part about this is the difference in the stories. Our story is at night and then in the morning. And the story in Ketubot is in the morning and at night. The Rashbam says about the story in Ketubot that it's on the same day. And he says about our story that it's on two different days. Our story was at night. She changed her name in the morning. It's the same halachic day, but it's not classified for contracts according to this, according to Rashbam, as being the same day. The day is determined by the waking day, not the halachic day. So that means that if the same day, which is the case in Ketubot, he calls it, where she did it in the morning and then changed her mind at night, that was considered to be the same day, even though halachically it was two different days. There might be a halachic definition, but contracts might follow what people normally do in contracts. So therefore, even though the date is different in the contract, the way the Rashbam is saying it, despite the difference in the date, that it would be the same day. Just saying that what the Rashbam does is very curious, because it does change the dynamic of what you consider to be the same day in terms of a shtar. Anyway, that's just a note in the Rashbam. First of all, reconciling with the Gemara in Ketubot, but second of all, that nuance about morning and night really has impact, unless you say that he's using it more loosely, that morning and night is not really night time, but rather night means late in the afternoon, but then you're already playing around with the wording, trying to get it to fit into the words of the Rishba. Eime de Rav Amram Chasida, havalo meluga de shtarai. The mother of Rav Amram Chasida had, here it's either a bundle, as you can see in the Rebbeinu Gershom, it's krichot arbe shel shtarot. It's a great bundle, a roll of shtarot, or a sack, a leather pouch full of shtarot. Kikash Chivra, when she was passing away, Amra de Havi la Amram Bri, give it to my son Amram. Ata Achua de Kamei de Rav Nachman. The brother shows up to Rav Nachman, Amrulei Valo Mashach. The brother comes and complains about the fact that it was all given to Rav Amram Chasida, and he says, Listen, he didn't make a kinyan on the shtarot. You need to make a kinyan in order for it to be binding. So now, he says over here, v'alo mashach, which is somewhat problematic. You can see here that the Masorah HaShas refers you to the Tosafot back on Pei Vav Amud Aleph, which is that a shtar does not really necessarily work with a kinyan mishicha. Because the Tosafot back on Pei Vav Amud Aleph says, v'hod ha'porech v'mishamet, our sugi over here, gami meluga d'shtari v'halo mashach, there wasn't a kinyan mishicha. The dochak tamar, she'a kol kach ha'be shtarot, she'lo yadarkan ha'gbiya. But it makes a case where you couldn't do a kinyan akbah. The main kinyan was a kinyan akbah. So it's very difficult to make a claim that it's a case where there were so many shtarot that it was so heavy that it wasn't normal anymore to do a kinyan akbah, and therefore you were permitted to do a kinyan mishicha. El alam daf nakat mashach. It is not exact when it says mashach el kumar below akbah. That the real kinyan there is a kinyan akbah, not a kinyan mishicha. Although that is interesting, because if you look at the Tosafot back on Ayin Vav Amud Aleph, he gives exactly that explanation for the case. Rav Natan Omer, Sfina b'mishicha v'otiyot b'misira u'bishtar. So Tosafot over there says, why do you need, how can you do a kinyan misira when Hagbah is a valid form of kinyan on a shtar? And when Hagbah is available, that's the only kinyan that we allow. So he says, oh hanach otiyot tishmaitin, all the cases here back in Ayin Vav and in Ayin Zayin that speak about a kinyan, whether otiyot or nitna the misira or any nitna misira, doesn't speak about a kinyan Hagbah. You have to say all these cases are tzrich lefresh b'sak malei shtarot shein derech la'agbiyah. It's a sack full of shtarot that you're unable to lift up. So over there, Tosafot gives that as an answer or a viable answer for explaining why the Gemara is using a form of kinyan that doesn't necessarily work by a shtar, is because it was too heavy. Then on Pei Vav, he says that that's not a valid answer. And our Gemara over here, when it says mashach, you can't take it literally. It really meant in Kinyan Akbah, it's just using Mashicha as an example, like the Mishnah in Kiddushin, for the form of Kinyan that is used by Metaltalin. But it also might relate to the Machloki between Rashi and the Rabbeinu Tam, the Rashbam and the Rabbeinu Tam, as to whether Kinyan Mashicha or Kinyan Misira is a better form of Kinyan. If you think that Kinyan Misira is a better form of Kinyan, like the Rabbeinu Tam, then it's harder to argue over here why you have Kinyan Mashicha mentioned if Kinyan Misira is required. On the other hand, if you think that Kinyan Misira is a lower form of Kinyan, and Kinyan Mashicha is better, then if Misira works by Ishtar or Kinyan Otiyot, then a Kinyan Mashicha also would work over there, and therefore you could mention over here, you could be speaking better here, a Kinyan Mashicha. You're still left with the ultimate problem, which Tosafot was trying to address, is why not a Kinyan Akbah when you're dealing with Shtarot? And Tosafot back on Ayin Vav suggests that it was a sack of Shtarot that were so heavy that you couldn't pick it up and it required a Kinyan Mashicha. Whereas the Tosafot on Pei Vav says just the opposite and says that's a dochak to say that that's the case. But rather, you have to say that our situation over here is a case where it is lav dafka Kinyan Mashicha. Basically, the Shtar works, so remember back on Ayin Zayin and Amud Aleph, you need a Kinyan Misira. You also need language that says, I'm giving you the shtar v'choshi budav, and all the encumbrances that are associated with it. And there was an opinion there that you might have to write another shtar. So in essence, what he's saying in shorthand is, there was no formal kinyan over here, not necessarily kinyan mishicha. Amalu, so he says back to them, divrei shchimira kichituvim uchemisurim damu. And again, all this information here is what we've taken for granted all along. This would have been the great introduction to this issue of Shchimera, because here are all the dinim that are coming out of Shchimera, which is that divrei Shchimera kichituvim ukemisurim dami. The words, the articulation of a Shchimera replaces the necessity for a kinyan. It's as if they are written and given to the recipient in that manner. So the question of how much that can overcome, we've already discussed this now. The basic premise that the Gemara has is that if a bari can create a kinyan, then the Shchimera can simulate the kinyan without the kinyan through dibor, through articulation. The question of how far that goes, can they simply just replace the kinyan? But if you have to say something in particular in this case, that's not replaced, you have to still say that. So for instance, in this case where you have to say, you're selling the shtar v'choshi budav, maybe here you'd have to say that as well. Or is the kinyan of Shchimera that is done through articulation, is it simply enough that you say, I'm gifting it, and then automatically, the institution of Chazal makes it that whatever you needed to have this kinyan happen, happens automatically as part of this takanat chachamim. So you could look at it one of two ways, and that would require more or less, in terms of the gifter, if there are these exogenous requirements besides the physical kinyan that takes place, can that be replaced by the milim, the words of the Shemira? Achte de Rav Tovi bar Rav Matno. The sister of Rav Tovi bar Rav Matno, katvino lenechsa de Rav Tovi bar Rav Matno. She gifted all of her possessions to Rav Tovi. Bitzafra, that was in the morning. Lepanyo, by the evening or the afternoon, at Rav Chodvai bar Rav Matno, her other brother showed up. Bochala starts bawling to her. Amarla, hashta amre mar tzuber mirabonon. Umar lav tzuber mirabonon. They're going to say that my brother is a young whippersnapper Talmud Chacham, and they're going to say that I'm not a Talmud Chacham, because you gifted all your assets to the other brother. That seems to indicate that he is of a higher stature, that he is a greater Talmud Chacham. That's why you gifted to him and you left me out. But that is something that's going to leave me shamed. How could you do that? Kadvino Niale, she then wrote and gifted all the property to her other brother. Atale Kameder of Nachman. So they went before Rav Nachman, Amalei, Hachi Amar Shmuel, again, a quote from Shmuel, Kol She'ilu Amad, Choser, anybody who, if they survived, could back out of the gift, Choser b'matanato, then they have a right to back out of it, even if they don't survive, meaning that the Shemir has a right to change their mind and change the gifting. So in this case, that gift would have been successful in terms of, or they transferred to the second party. So Rav Chodvai would get it instead of Rav Tovi. So again, Rav Tovi was actually much more famous than his brother, Rav Chodvai. And for that reason, Rav Chodvai is justifiably coming to his sister and saying that if you give it to my other brother, who is of a higher stature and more well-known, it's going to imply that I'm just a nobody. And he was, in a sense, relative to his brother, not of a person of such fame or stature, and therefore he felt offended, or he felt that it would just reinforce what was probably already true. And so therefore he asked his sister to gift it to him instead, to give him that status, or to give him at least some equal footing with his brother. So she transferred instead all the assets to her other brother, Rav Chodvai. Achtei de Rav Dimi bar Yosef, habala piskato de pardesa. The sister of Rav Dimi bar Yosef had this section of an orchard or section of a vineyard. Every time she fell ill, have a maknayale nihale. She would give it to her brother. She would basically bequeath it to her brother every time she felt ill. And then, she had 9 lives. She survived many illnesses. And every time she gifted it to him when she fell ill, and when she got better, she took it back from him. So, once again, she fell ill. Shalchale, she called for her brother. Ta Knei. Come and take possession of it. Shalach lo beinan. I don't need it. I'm not interested. He had enough of this. Every time I take it, she survives and then she takes it back. What am I going, what am I going through all this trouble for? It's enough. Shalchale, so she sends back to him, ta knei kohecha debayit. So she says, come and take possession of it in any way you want. Meaning that, come and take it in a way that you feel comfortable taking it. In essence, what she's almost permitting him to do is create a kinya now that will not be overridden by her surviving. It's not going to be a matnat shemira anymore. So of course, what does he do? Azal, shayro. He left over a piece of the property for her. That's what we call a matnat shemira bimiktsat. And then, vikanu mina. And then he made a kinyan. So he did the two requirements in order to make it a binding gift, which is irreversible, which is number one, he left over property for the Shemira, and number two is he made a kinyan on it, which are the requirements of a matnat Shemira b'miktsat. Again, that's actually going to be discussed in the upcoming Gemara. We know that already because we know the conclusion of the Gemara, but that's just about to be discussed. Kikaima, sure enough, she survived once again. Hajaba, she reneged on the gift. She took it back again. Atei lekameid Rav Nachman. So now they came before Rav Nachman. He's holding on to it, and she wants her stuff back. So she goes to Rav Nachman. Shalach le ta. Rav Nachman sent for Rav Dimi bar Yosef to show up in court. He subpoenaed him. Lo ata. He didn't show up. Amar mai ite. What does she have? She has no claim over here. Hashaira v'kanumina. I left over a piece for her. I made a kinyan. I did everything that would make it a binding agreement by which she would have no right of retraction. Shalachlei iloachtit mechina lecha b'silva delo maba damo. Says, if you don't show up, I'm going to prick you with a prick or with a thorn that causes pain but does not have any blood that flows. Something that's painful without drawing any blood, it's not torture, but rather it's referring to nidui, that he's going to excommunicate him in this case, which is that something that's painful without any blood being drawn. The idea of it being like a pin or a needle is because of the seriousness of being put into nidui. So he subpoenaed him, and he refused to come, and he says, if you don't show up for the subpoena, you're going to be held in contempt of court, and we're going to put you into nidui. So Amar lehu l'sade. So then Rav Nachman asks the witnesses, Eichi ava maaseh? What was the case? What happened here? Amru lei, so they said to him, Amra hachi, she said the following, Vai dekamita hachitata. Whoa, it's enough that this woman is passing away, or basically, halavai, that I should pass away. The simple reading of this is, she was so ill at this point, and she was in pain, and she was basically saying, I'm ready to pass away. She's saying, I'm ready to die because it's just too much to be alive. So she basically made a claim that she is dying and that she wants to die at this point. That's the way the Rabbeinu Gershom looks. It learns it, which is machmat chulya hakasha. She was under duress because of the difficulty of her sickness. Because zvurai lamut, and she thought she was going to die. And she says, you know, halavaya should die at this point. It's enough. And that's why she granted the gift to him, because she said, I'm going to the next world. The other hand, the Rashbam learns it. I don't think this is as simple a way to explain it, but he does learn it this way. She said the following. V'lo tir'eh et achia. Halavaya this woman should pass away and not see her brother. She'ena rotzeh lavo ilai. Because he doesn't want to come and see me anymore. She's like bemoaning her circumstance. My brother used to come to see me every time I fell ill. This time I fell ill, my brother's unwilling to come and see me. So and my time has come. I may as well die now because my brother doesn't even bother to show up when I'm passing away. So it's not a simple interpretation, but the Rishbam is filling it into the story of this tension between the brother and the sister. Amar lehu. So then Rav Nachman says to them, Imkain, hava mitzaveh machmat mita. That's someone who's commanding because of death. Umitzaveh machmat mita. Someone who commands based on their dying, chuzer, has a right of retraction. So here we're introduced to another category that is in this world of Matnat Shechem Mirah. Again, the fine line between a Matnat Shechem Mirah and Mitzaveh Machmat Mita, someone who's commanding because they are dying. I'll just use a broad stroked difference, or to explain the difference between them, is that a Matnat Shechem Mirah is someone who is sick and ill on their deathbed and starts to give away their property or gift their property. It's a Matnat Shechem Mirah because of the Umdana Hadat. It's because of the circumstantial evidence, which seems to indicate to us that they are giving away their property or gifting their property because of the circumstance that they find themselves in. A mitzaveh machmat mita is someone who, in essence, articulates, I am dying, therefore. So they state explicitly that the death is the cause for the gift. And so it's no longer implicit, but explicit that whatever they're doing is connected to the mita. The Rishonim over here discuss how explicit it needs to be. Do they have to connect the gift directly to that fact that they are dying? Or simply the mention of death is enough in the context of gifting that already gives you the same or simulates the effect of being mitzaveh machmat mita. And what Rav Nachman is saying over here, which is important, is that mitzaveh machmat mita can be chuzer. And that's what the Rishbam says over here. Chol mitzaveh machmat mita chuzer ben b'matana b'miksat. Doesn't matter if you give everything away or if you only give a portion of your assets away. And even if you have a kinyan. If you survive, you can retract everything. It becomes an explicit condition of the gift. It becomes embedded as an explicit condition of the gift. And therefore, you have a right of retraction if you survive. The person said, I am dying, and then starts to gift. Or it says, I'm dying, therefore I'm gifting, and therefore it becomes a part and parcel of the gift, that I'm dying. If they don't die, then they can retract the gift, no matter what was done here, how much was given away, or no matter whether there was a kinyan made. Matnat Shechem Mirah requires an umdana adat. Umdana adat is that we are now, through the circumstantial evidence, trying to conclude what the person was thinking when they gifted. Did they just gift, and they had no intentions of retracting it, or did they gift because they are passing away? Over there, we give you qualifications. If you give it all away, that seems to indicate that you intended the gift to be because you're passing away, because you didn't leave anything for yourself. If you only do matana b'miksat, you kept what you could use to survive, that means that you considered that fact and you gave away the gift anyway. irrespective of it. But this is all umdanadat. We're trying to figure out, based on the circumstances, what they were thinking. There was no articulation of that. And so therefore we conclude, when you give it all away, that we think you are doing it because of mita, you only give it a portion of way. And same thing with kinyan. Kinyan would also be, you only need a kinyan if you think you want to make it a full-fledged gift. If you don't want to make it a full-fledged gift, they might not shkumir, it works without a kinyan. So if you enter a kinyan, maybe that's locking it in because our umdanadat. What we're thinking is that you gifted it irrespective of passing away. But where the passing away is an explicit reference or condition of the a gift, there you can retract no matter what has happened. Itmar, matnat shkemira b'miktzat. If someone grants a matnat shkemira b'miktzat, not all of his possessions, but a portion of his possessions, amru rabbanan kamei derova, mishmei demar zutra brei derav nachman, damar mishmei demar av nachman, so we have a mesorah from nachman, harehi k'matnat bari. It has the same status as a matnat bari. Bari ki matnat shkemira. It's also like a matnat shkemira. Harehi ki matnat bari shimamad enu chuzer. It's like a matnat bari, which is, if you have a gift that's given when a person is of fine health, you can't retract the gift. The gift is binding once you have given it. So too over here, just like a matnat bari is irreversible, so too a matnat shkemira mixed is irreversible. Bari ki matnat shkemira delo bayi kinyan. On the other hand, it's like a matnat shkemira, which is that it does not require a kinyan. So here, this is unlike the halachot that we've seen until now. This is unlike what we've said until now, which is that a matnat shkemira b'miktzat does not require a kinyan. No necessity for a kinyan. On the other hand, it is binding. Unlike a matnat shkemira b'kulei, matnat shkemira b'miktzat is binding, and even if they survive, you can't retract it. Amalu Rova. Rova says to them, after they brought all of this, Lava minuluchu, didn't I already tell you? Lo titlu buki usriki b'Rav Nachman. Don't put these empty pitchers in the name of Rav Nachman, or in essence, it's a flask full of air. Don't put all this hot air in Rav Nachman. What you said, it cannot be true. And you're misquoting Rav Nachman. Remember, Rava is a Talmid of Rav Nachman. And so Rava is saying back to them, what they're quoting from Rav Nachman is wrong. Hachi amar Rav Nachman. This is what Rav Nachman said. Harik matnat bari ubayi kinyan. It's a full-fledged matnat bari, and therefore requires a kinyan, and that's what we've known until now. This is the conclusion that we've drawn, which is that a matnat shkemira b'miktzat, first of all, is irrevocable, but it requires a kinyan in order to seal it. It's not enough to be articulated, it requires a kinyan as well. So here you have a machloket as to whether a matnat shkemira b'miktzat requires a kinyan, or does not require a kinyan. Rova says in the name of Nachman, it does require a kinyan. And then before we had the Rabbanan, who were bringing it in the name of Marzutra, brother of Nachman, in the name of Rav Nachman, that you do not require a kinyan. Eitvei Rova, the Rav Nachman. So now Rova challenges Rav Nachman. Shier karkokoshu. He left over a small portion of property. Matanatanato kayemet. The matana survives irrespective of what happens to the individual. That's our Mishnah. Our Mishnah says that if you have a matanat shkemira b'miktzat, then that is binding to the point where it's irreversible. My lab, dolo konomine. The Mishnah doesn't mention any kinyan. It simply says it's matnat shkemira b'miktzat. So Rava is challenging his Rebbe, Rav Nachman, who said that matnat shkemira b'miktzat requires a kinyan. What are you going to do with the Mishnah that doesn't mention kinyan? Lo, the konomine. No, there was a kinyan. Ihoche eima seifa. If that is true, what are you going to do with the latter half of our Mishnah? Lo shiar karka lo shu. If you left nothing over and you gifted the entire property, Ein matanato kayemet. If the person survives, the matanat does not survive. Vi de konomine, but if there was a kinyan, amai ein matanato kayemet. If there was a kinyan, then you're not using a matnat shkemira as the mechanism, you're using a regular kinyan as the mechanism. In that case, it should be an irreversible transaction. Amalei ochi amar Shmuel. So now Rav Nachman quotes from his Rebbe Shmuel. So Rava, the Talmud of Rav Nachman, is challenging Rav Nachman. Rav Nachman answers by quoting Shmuel. Shkemira shekatav kol nechasav la'acherim. A person who writes or gifts all of his property to another party, even if there was a kinyan in that case, amad chozer. If he survives, you have a right of retraction. The reason is because we know the only reason he was gifting it is because of the death, which is, in essence, the umdana adat now becomes the equivalent of mitzaveh machmat mita. That's what the Rashbam says over here. Hovelo shir, since you left nothing over. You never made an explicit reference to death over here, but the umdana adat, the circumstantial evidence, points to the fact that you definitely do it, mishum mita, because you left nothing over for yourself. That means you did not consider the possibility you would survive. You assumed you were going to die, and that's why you granted the gift. And it can even override in kinyan. Now Rav Mishashia challenges Rava. There was an incident with the mother of the family of Rochel. She had fallen ill. Vamra, and she says, Tinatein kvinati the bt. Give my brooch to my daughter. Rashi calls it a nushka, which is in Rashi a choker, a necklace that was a choker. Give that to my daughter. Although the Balei Tosafot on Kufnun Vav Amud Bet say that they think that that explanation of Kvinati is incorrect. They prove it from the Gemara and Shabbat, and therefore they bring the Perush Aruch, that Kvinati here is an atara, some sort of crown that has something sharp that protrudes from it, but it is not something that is put around the neck of the woman, but more of a crown or adornment that is put on top of their head. V'ho b'shnei masar maneh. It's worth 1,200 zuz. Umeita, and she passed away. V'kayimu divareha. And they upheld her instructions. Over here, she has sons who are going to inherit. She then takes a piece of property and gives it to her daughter in order that her daughter will have something, because she's not one of the Yorshim. It would only be the males that would inherit over here. And she articulated it. And then when she passed away, they followed through on what she had asked. Hut. So now the question, according to the Rashbam, comes from the fact that it says Vikimu Divareha, that they upheld her word. The assumption here is that the brooch was not the only thing she owned, that there was other property or other assets in the estate. So this is a matnat shemira b'miksat. It's only a portion of her assets. She's giving them to her daughter. And the Chachamim consider it to be binding because kimo dvareha. They upheld her word or what she said, implying that there was no kinyan over here. There was simply an articulation. Where it says, atam mimitzaveh achmat mita. The case over there was a case where she did command it explicitly based on her death. Even though we don't see it there, that was the case. The case was that there was a mention of death is part of that gifting to her daughter. Tosafot over here challenges the questioner a little bit and says, why did she have to pass away? If according to this individual, a matnat shchivra b'miksat is binding without a kinyan, even if she didn't pass away, the gift would have been enforceable. So Tosafot in one answer says, ein ochanami, the Gemara could have asked that question or could have undermined this statement based on that question. But it went ahead and chose a different route in order to solve the problem. Or he says there's a possibility that this questioner believed that it does not require a kinyan, but it also is not a binding gift if the individual survives. So it doesn't have that standard of kinyan in order for it to be enforceable if the person passes away. But if they do survive, then it will not be an enforceable gift because there was no kinyan. Eitvei Ravina, the Rav, so now Ravina challenges Rava in this issue that he brought from Rav Nachman is the fact that you need a kinyan by a matan shkivi Rav Miksat. Someone who says, give this get to my wife. Ushtar shechru zel abdi, or this document of emancipation to my slave. Umeit. Then he passed away. Lo yitnu lachar mita. You can't grant them after death. The reason obviously is, there's no such thing as a divorce after death. There's no such thing as emancipation after death. Since it wasn't given prior to the death, you can't give it after the death because it won't be effective after the death of the individual. Tznuman eloploni, umate. He says, or he instructs the person to give it to so-and-so, and then they passed away. Yitnu lachar mita. Then you can give that money even after the individual was the bequeather over here passed away. You can give the money to the recipient. Umimai, how can I prove to you over there, delo kan umine? How do you know over there that's a case where there was no kinyan involved? All it says is, tnu get liishti, or tnu mane liploni. So why can't you just say that there was a kinyan over there, and that's why it is binding? She says, you can't say that. To dumi the get. In the case, it parallels the case of giving the money to that of the get. Ma get la bar kinyan. Just like a get, there's no kinyan on a get that has to be given to the woman or into her possession. There's no kinyan over here. Avhai nami lo kanu mine. So to the case of Tnu Mane Leploni is also a case where there was no kinyan. The Rava answers again, Otum Nami b'mitzavem achmat mita. That it was a case where they were given their last will and testament, explicitly made reference to the fact that the person was going to die, And therefore, you don't need a kinyan in that case, because that's mitzaveh machmat mita. Tosafot over here makes a distinction between the language of tnu and tain. And he says that our Gemara specifically uses the language of tnu, because tnu implies that the get is yet to be written, and he's commanding them to write the get, and then deliver the get. On the other hand, if it says tain get zeh, the Bali Tosafot suggests that implies that the get has already been written, and he's just telling the shliach to deliver the get that's already there. And does that to avoid entering into the machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim that's found in Gittin. On the other hand, if it does say 10 here, then you would have to say it is subject to that machloket, as to whether a get is considered to be a zchut, or it's not considered a zchut, or the get shichrur, document of emancipation, whether that's a zchut for the ever or not a zchut for the ebed. Although the Ri does not really accept this differentiation in language, and says that the chiddush over here is simply that even though the person appointed a shliach, an agent, to act on their behalf to give the get, and shlucho shel adam kemoto, even though it was set in motion before he passed away and should have been able to survive his death because the person was already empowered, what we say here is that that doesn't work. And therefore you can't give the get or the document of emancipation after the death of the individual. Vona, Breder Yehushu Amar, Mitzaveh Machmat Mitav Ba'alma Ba'yikinyan. That if one commands based on the articulation that they're passing away, you require a kinyan. V'chi tane hane matnaita. Then all these brito de mishnah is b'michalei kol nechasav, is when he's distributing all of his property. When you're distributing all the property, then there's no requirement of a kinyan. When you're distributing only a portion of the property, even b'mitzaveh machmat mita, you require a kinyan. Da'i matnat shchimira shavua, because that is the case, or that's the circumstance in which the chachamim considered it to be a matnat shchimira, the last will and testament. That's where you give away all your assets. In essence, what he's saying here is that b'mitzaveh machmat mita is the equivalent of a matnat shchemira, and there's no differentiation between the umdan adat and the explicit reference. The umdan adat makes like an explicit reference, and the din by matnat shchemira is there's a differentiation between matna b'mitzah and matna b'kulei. That same differentiation will apply to a mitzaveh machmat mita. Ve'ochata. And the loch is matnat shchemira b'mitzat b'yikinyan. The locha is like the version of Rav Nachman brought by Rova, that a matnat shchemira b'miksat requires a kinyan. V'af agav demeit, and even if he passed away, you don't get it unless you had a kinyan on it. It's not binding unless you have a kinyan. Mitzaveh machmat mita, when it comes to someone is giving instructions, and there they mention the issue of death explicitly, lo bayi kinyan. Though you don't need a kinyan there, v'ho demeit. That's if they passed away. If they passed away, the gift is binding, irrespective if they gifted everything or if they gifted a portion of it. It is binding if they pass away. But Amad, if they survive, Choser, you can retract or renege on the gift. Even if there was a kinyan there, and even if it was a matnah b'miksat, you have a right of retraction because there becomes a tenai, a condition of the gift, because of the explicit nature of mentioning death in the context of the gift. That makes it as if it's embedded in the gift, that if the person dies, the gift will go through. If the person doesn't die, then they'll have a right of retraction over there. All right, we're going to stop here at the bottom of Kufnun Aleph Amud Bet.